This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hi, I'm happy to welcome you to the People Speak radio show. I'm Allison Weir, tonight's host. The People Speak normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific time, which is where I am, and 9 to 10 Eastern time on the BBS radio network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests. The phone number for people in the U.S. and Canada, this is, of course, a toll-free number, is 888-429-5471. Again, that's 888-429-5471. This is an especially important show tonight, I feel, because we have a wonderful guest. Greta Berlin is one of the most committed, principled, courageous, people working for justice for Palestinians in the world. She's internationally known. Greta is the founder of the Flotilla Movement, one of the co-founders of the Free Gaza Movement. She's the editor of an excellent book called Freedom Sailors, The Maiden Voyage of the Free Gaza Movement and How We Succeeded in Spite of Ourselves. Greta, I'm so happy to welcome you to the show tonight.
So much. First of all, Allison, it's great to hear from you, and I'm hoping when I finally get back to California, I'll have a chance to see you. And I'm overwhelmed with your introduction. Thank you.
Sure. Well, as I said, we're all honored that you're on the show. It's you're a historic figure, but some people, I'm sure there are quite a few people that are very new to this issue and may not know your background. So it would be great if we could just start out by telling a little bit how and when you got involved in working for justice for Palestine, and then how you started the Flotilla Movement, a little bit about the beginnings there.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I like a lot of people who are involved in the Justice for Palestine movement, we have met a Palestinian somewhere along the line. They've been our roommates or our friends. And in my case, I married a Palestinian. He's a 1948 refugee. And I had met him in 1963. And I was a Chicago public school teacher. That's what I was doing for a living. And on June 5th of 1967, I went to bed, a nice little Chicago public school teacher, and I woke up the next morning finding that Israel had attacked most of the Arab countries around it and, of course, was busy attacking the Palestinians as well, and I became an instant advocate for Palestine, and I have never left. So it's been, 48 years that I have been involved in working with Palestinians, going to the occupied West Bank, sailing boats to Gaza, and I have seen tremendous changes in people's attitudes towards Palestinians, and I think that's because many of us have worked continuously to make sure the public understands that the Palestinians are an occupied and oppressed people.
That's right. So it's still surprising how many people don't know that. Although, of course, it's not too surprising since most people get their information from the mainstream media. And on both sides, there's very little, very rarely do we even hear the term occupied or occupation. So I guess, you know, I guess most of us, I woke up much more recently than you did, 16 years ago approximately. I probably didn't know that. I knew very little about the issue in general, so I think most people, I think that's of course one of the big problems is most people don't know that.
You know, it is a problem, but because I have a perspective now of almost five decades of being involved in work with the Palestinians, I see a tremendous change. I think the biggest change that has come along is because of social media. Once social media came along, I don't care whether it was Twitter or Facebook or all of the email accounts that people have, people even in the United States did begin to learn. And it's one of the reasons I'm quite heartened over the fact that the news about Palestine is becoming much more obvious, even to the American public. I live in Europe. And so, of course, I see it from a much different perspective now that I live there. Most Europeans are quite familiar with the occupation of Palestine. It's the Americans that are sort of slowly coming around and paying attention to what I consider to be the one of the worst abuses, human rights abuses, since World War II, and that is the occupation, and I call it the ongoing slow-motion genocide of the Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim.
That's right, and as you say, it's been ongoing for all this time, you know, since the end of World War II, really. Since, you know, I guess 1947 is when I would basically date that from happening. So this is a major event, and yet, and I agree with you, certainly with the internet now and social media, people are learning much more than they did before. That awareness is forcing the media themselves to cover it a little bit more accurately, with a little bit more honesty. So that's another way that it has improved over these years. I know I spoke recently about the subject just a few months ago here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And some very politically aware people were at my talk. And it was interesting because afterwards they said, well, you know, I always knew it was sort of bad, but they had no idea how bad it was and the whole history of it. But at least at that point they had something of an idea. And, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, fewer people probably would have said that. So that's been a big change.
Yeah, and I think it is a change, and I that's why I tend to be the incurable optimist, that I think that eventually Palestine will, continue to call it Palestine. Palestine will be a state for everybody, and that's Jews and Christians and Muslims and Druze and atheists and whoever used to live there before the European Jews came in and took over Palestine. The Palestinians were living quite contentedly with each other for centuries. And so I think that it will eventually go back to that. I think it's interesting you said that you had given a presentation. I'm in Chicago right now, and I was talking to a woman who was 86, and she had heard about Freedom Sailors, and she lives in the building where I'm staying right now. And she said, "You don't happen to have an extra copy, do you?" And of course, I always carry the book with me. And I said, "Yeah, I'd be happy to give it to you." And she said, "You know, I always knew that there was something really wrong about what had happened to the Palestinians, but I could never put my finger on it." And she said, "I'm 86 years old, and I started to do my own research, and I just wanted you to know that I'm really looking forward to reading the book about the voyages." And I was so surprised, because it isn't like you. I'm not accustomed to having people come up and say to me, "Oh, yes, we're really interested in this," or, "Oh, yes, we'd like to read your book." And that's relatively new. That's only been in the last few years.
That's a good place for us to get into the origins of the book, which I remember when you first had the idea. Just a handful of other people, quite a few years ago, had this dream that you were going to get a boat, a large boat, but a boat, not really what you'd normally call a ship, and sail it to Gaza, that people would, you know, that there would be a way to go to Gaza rather than having to go through Israeli-controlled areas, which is Israel, of course, controls all of the borders of Gaza, except theoretically not the sea border. So you had this dream of getting a boat. And can you tell us what year that was and just a little bit about how that all began and where you went with that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It started in 2006 when Israel was busy attacking Lebanon. And a group of us, there were five actually, of us, and we had all been members of the International Solidarity Movement. If anybody knows what the ISM is, they'll know because of the murder of Rachel Corrie, who was with the ISM when, and the bulldozer ran over her. So the ISM was quite well known in the West Bank and in Gaza. And so we were all veterans of the International Solidarity Movement, and we were all denied entrance back into the occupied West Bank. So we started to think, where else can we go and how else can we help? And so somebody, his name was Michael Shake from Australia, wrote an email and he said, you know, I have this vision of buying a boat in New York and sailing it across the Atlantic and down the coast of Europe and into Gaza. And I was sitting in Mary Hughes Thompson's living room. She's one of the co-founders. And she and I looked at each other and we said, let's do it. And that's how it started. Of course, we had no idea, by the way, what we were doing. We got three other people, Paul DeRudy in the Bay Area, and two lovely Australians, Sharon Locke and Renee Boyer. And we all had this grand idea that we were going to buy a boat and sail it to Gaza. Now, remember, this is 2006. We didn't go until August of 2008. So it took us 2 years to put this together. We had no Twitter. There wasn't any such thing at the time. There was no Facebook. It was just beginning. So we organized all of this on Gmail groups, and we trusted each other because the majority of us who were in, that were working on the project were all veterans of the International Solidarity Movement. I do want to say that this was not an ISM project, but it was those of us who had already been in the West Bank, had already seen what the Israelis had done, and had already been part of a movement to try to get the world to understand what was happening to the Palestinians. So that's literally how it started. And I'd have to say that none of us had any boating experience. That the book, Freedom Sailors, one of the reasons it's so much fun to read it is because people who read the book think they're never going to make it. Now, everybody knows we did make it, but when you read how crazy we were and how naive we were and how we had no idea how to buy a boat and no idea what to do with the boat once we had the boat. And even when the Greeks finally found two boats for us, just because they're Greek, no, the Greeks kind of said, we are the wayfarers, we are the people of the sea, so we will find a boat for you. Well, that was great, but the problem was they had never sailed a boat either. And even when they put the boat together, one of the boats together, they put the steering column on backwards, for example. So when the captain got on board the boat called the Free Gaza and tried to get it to the next island, the boat went backwards in front instead of forwards and sideways right instead of left and ended up on a sandbar. And those are all some of the stories that are in this book of how crazy. That's why we say we succeeded in spite of ourselves.
It's just truly an astounding, exciting, gripping, dramatic story. I think everybody should get the book. I know it's available on Amazon. I think the Kindle version is only about $10. So I really urge
it. It's got lots of photos in it, and you'll laugh. People will laugh, and they'll cry as well because the Palestinian, for example, who was on board the Free Gaza, we had two boats. Called the Free Gaza and the U.S. Liberty, and I'll get back to the reason why we called that the Liberty in a minute. And there was one Palestinian. His name was Mushir El Farah. He's Palestinian from Gaza, and he was determined he was going to go. And we were so late, and we were so delayed, and there were 44 of us, and we were hot, and we were tired, and we were staying in Cyprus. And the boats hadn't come, and the boats hadn't come. And Mushir kept saying, yes, they will come, yes, they will come. You can bet they will come. And, of course, eventually the boats did. And when he got on the Free Gaza and we went across the sea and Israel had blocked all of our communications, most people who were following us at the time thought we had drowned because we were out of complete contact with the world for about 20 hours. And it's because Israel blocked everything. They blocked our GPS. They blocked our cell phones, our satellite phones. They blocked everything. We had two wonderful captains, and they were literally navigating on paper. because it's the only way we could get across the sea. And when the sun came up the next morning, and we were so many people were seasick, and within 2 or 3 hours we saw the shores of Gaza, we realized that we were not going to be stopped, that we were actually going to get into Gaza. And Mushir got on his knees and he said, "I see my house. I see where I was born." And it's a day on August 23rd, 2008 that I will never, ever forget.
Let me remind any listeners who are just tuning in now that we're speaking with Greta Berlin, and she's talking about the first voyage of the Free Gaza movement, in which they took a boat and made it to Gaza. I remember some of the time, you know, when you were all planning this and talking over what it would be, and some of what you were having to anticipate and figure out how you would react would be if what was quite likely, if the Israeli military boarded the ship and the boat and held a gun to your head and told you to turn around, how you would respond to that. You know, these are very terrifying scenarios that were sadly, very plausible types of scenarios that you were facing when you decided to take this voyage. I think people don't realize the kind of courage it took to get on that boat and to do what you did.
No, I think that that's true. There were 44 of us, and on that first trip, nobody was really famous. I suppose we could say that Jeff Halper, who's with the ICAT in Israel, was probably a relatively famous name, and the sister-in-law Lauren Booth of Tony Blair was also on the boat. But we were really all activists, every single one of us. I mean, we had borrowed money on our credit cards in order to stay, and to make sure that we were actually going to go from Cyprus. When the boats actually came in on the 21st of August, I turned around because I was in charge of the people in Cyprus. I turned around and I asked every person who was there, "Are you willing to get on these boats? Because if you are not, and if you are afraid that you might die, please step aside." And nobody did. Everybody got on that boat, both boats. And it was really remarkable, because what Israel had been busy saying is that there were a bunch of teenagers and they were trying to sail across the sea and they didn't have anything better to do. But of course, the reality of it was is that most of us were over 60. So then they started calling us the aging hippies, is what they said we were. And it's because many of us who were over 60, our children were already grown, we didn't have to worry about it. And we pretty much told everyone who came on those two boats, "We will not take you if you have small children." And the only person we did take who had small children was Lauren Booth, and she was just the most amazing sailor. She was remarkable, and she loved the idea that she got to Gaza before her brother-in-law, Tony Blair, did.
She is amazing, and what you all accomplished was truly just brilliant and courageous and inspiring. I think that it would be good to tell people about the voyages that took place after that and what happened in those cases. I know there are quite a few, so probably we can't tell about everyone, but, you know, to at least tell a few of them.
There have been 15 voyages total, and there's a new one coming up in September, which is called the Women's Boat to Gaza. Free Gaza had already kind of sent a women's boat anyhow on the first flotilla, and so the flotilla organization thought, gee, that would be a great idea if not only were all the passengers women, but so was the captain and so was the first mate. So that's what's going to happen in September. Out of those 15 voyages, 5 of them were successful. By the time we got in there that first time, people were so astounded. You know, what was so remarkable is that people actually believed in us. We had women sending us their Social Security check, and veterans sending us their veterans benefits checks. This was, I often say, we were sort of like the Bernie Sanders of boat trips, where everybody, just the common people, wanted to have be a part of that boat trip, and so they sent in whatever they could, and we ended up raising close to $700,000 to buy those two boats and to actually go. So once that happened, we were overwhelmed with people who wanted to donate. So we bought a yacht, and we got into Gaza 4 more times. By that time, we were taking in people like Mairead Maguire, who's the Nobel Peace Prize winner from Ireland, and members of Parliament. We took in Cynthia McKinney. We were no longer taking just activists in. We were taking people who were high profile so they could see what was happening in Gaza. And so we set a precedent. Israel never stopped us. There was no reason for them to stop us. We never went to Israel. We went straight from international waters into the waters of Gaza. So we had gotten in 5 times. So when they started to stop us, we were shocked. We couldn't understand. I think in retrospect, what they thought is, after that first trip, they thought these aging hippies would somehow go in, visit Gaza, and then go away. And they had no idea how determined we were. And by the time the 5th trip came along, they realized we were coming in once or twice a month. And the Operation Cast Lead is what stopped it. And so since December of 2008, we have never been able to get in successfully again. They have stopped us. They've hijacked our boats. They've murdered our passengers. They've wounded over 150 to 170 of our passengers. They've taken our boats, not given them back, taken everything that we've had on board our boats, and yet we still go. We still haven't quit. We're still going.
Now, I know I think it's the Mavi Marmara is probably one of the ones that people have heard about. Weren't there 9 people, 9 of the people on board were killed by Israeli soldiers? Is that the correct number?
There were 10. One died, I think, 2 or 3 years later, but he had been in a coma since he'd been shot. So there were 10 passengers that were murdered on board the Mavi Marmara, one who was an American. His name was Furkan Dogan. And he had been born in the United States to Turkish parents and carried an American passport. And so there are still suits ongoing in the United States to hold Israel accountable for the death of the American passenger. He was only 19 years old. And that was the first flotilla. And that flotilla was organized by Free Gaza and the Turkish charity and the European Campaign to End the Siege and a joint Swedish-Greek initiative. And that's how we started the flotillas. So by that time, people were so enthusiastic about sailing to Gaza that we started out with 9 boats. Actually, I should call 3 of them ships because the Mavi Marmara was actually a ship, and so were the 2 cargo ships that were going. And then there were a bunch of smaller boats. And so when they attacked the Mavi Marmara, that's what everybody remembers. We were 65 miles off the coast of Gaza in international waters at 4:30 in the morning. I was in the office in Cyprus watching the television and talking to our flotilla leader, whose name was Lubna Marsawa. And all of a sudden, we saw the commandos come down from the helicopters and raise their rifles, and they shot out all of the TV cameras. And so what people need to realize is that the soldiers who Israel continues to say that they were provoked, but every single person on every single boat was attacked. We had one boat called the Challenger, and on board were about 12 women. They shot one point blank in the face, broke her nose with a paintball gun. They threw other women into the glass. They were cut. They were wounded. They put bags over the heads of women on the sea, something you never, ever do, and then they handcuffed them. You cannot do that. It's against maritime law to treat people like that, and yet Israel continues to get away with it.
That's right, and I know a number of those that were killed were, it turned out later with autopsies, it was very clear they'd been shot at close range. I think times in the head.
Some of them were shot 6 and 7 times, and they said, well, they had picked up the bottoms of aluminum chairs and they had taken the aluminum legs off the bottom in order to protect the boat. And I'm always surprised when somebody who's an apologist for Israeli action says to me, well, they shouldn't have attacked the Israelis who were boarding the boat. I said, the Israelis were coming on board the boat, heavily armed, coming down from a helicopter, and you're telling me that nobody has the right to protect their boat? They had no guns. They had nothing. They were doing their best to try to protect the boat and the passengers. And ironically, all of the people who were murdered had one weapon in their hands, and that was a camera.
That's right, and that's what Israel doesn't want. Well, we're approaching, we're at the bottom of the hour already, which means we're going to have to take a break for just a minute or so. This is The People Speak. I'm Allison Weir. I'm speaking with Greta Berlin, and the founder of the Free Gaza Movement, and which founded the whole flotilla movement. She's the author of an excellent book, and she will be with us in the second half of the hour. We'll also be able to answer questions, probably. You can call in to 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. And when we're back with Greta, we'll talk a little bit more about what happened to Cynthia McKinney, for example, a former U.S. Congresswoman and a Nobel laureate. What happened to them when they were on these boats as well? I believe we're going to. I'm a little new at being a radio host, as maybe people can tell, but I think we're supposed to go to a message now.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to The People Speak. I'm your host, Allison Weir, and we're back with our guest tonight, Greta Berlin, who's been telling us about the flotillas to Gaza. The very first one she was on, that they had the dream in 2006. 2008, they actually made it into Gaza. They had 5 successful voyages, and then after that were 10 more, in which the Israeli military, one of the most powerful militaries on the planet, attacked these unarmed boats and flotillas trying to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza, one of the densest places on earth and one of the most impoverished places on earth because of what Israel has done to the Palestinian people. Greta, you were mentioning, I thought you could mention just a little bit about two of the very prominent people that were on board some of your boats, Cynthia McKinney, who was a congresswoman from Atlanta in the U.S. Congress, and Mairead McGuire, who was an Irish Nobel laureate. They were both on those boats, and what happened to them, their treatment?
Well, Mairead McGuire was on our third successful trip. She went in with a lot of members of the European Parliament, plus Baroness Jenny Tong, for example. So she had already managed to get in successfully on the third trip. On the trip of July of 2009, both Mairead McGuire and Cynthia McKinney were on our new boat that was called the Spirit of Humanity. And that was the first time, that was the first boat that the Israelis boarded, hijacked the boat, and kidnapped all the passengers. So you now have all of these passengers who are being hauled into Ashdod, Israel, against their will, the boat being hijacked, never given back to us, and then all of the passengers thrown into holding cells and told that they had to sign paperwork saying they had entered Israel illegally. I mean, the irony of that is just almost mind-blowing because they didn't want to go to Israel, and they didn't sign the paperwork. What Cynthia McKinney did, which is brilliant, you can find it online, is she wrote a letter from the Israeli prison very similar to what Martin Luther King had done from the Birmingham jail. And it's an eloquent and beautiful piece of writing that Cynthia McKinney did. Mairead, apparently, because Mairead is Irish and was a bit upset that everybody had been kidnapped and thrown into prison, refused to cooperate. And so they put her in solitary confinement for a couple of days. Of course, everybody was released eventually. But why should they have to go to Ashdod? And that was, I think we had 18 passengers on board that boat. We've never gotten the boat back, and the supplies that we had on the boat were never delivered. I did want to say one thing. The Free Gaza movement has always had a mission of sailing into Gaza to break Israel's illegal siege. The fact that we can sail in means that we also take things with us. But we are not, our mission is not to deliver supplies. Our mission is to break the siege of Gaza, and we take what we can, but it's a drop in the bucket for what people really need in Gaza.
That's true. You know, there's malnutrition. There's extreme hardship. There's some stunting of children's growth. They're concerned about because of the siege that Gaza's been placed under for now. It's about 10 years, I guess. That just goes on and on. And here we have, you know, again, it's just always astounding to me what Israel gets away with. This should have been a major international incident, with a Nobel laureate being treated this way, the Honorable Cynthia McKinney, who had been in the U.S. Congress. Normally, the U.S. government would do, you know, this would be very serious to treat high officials this way, and yet Israel does it consistently. And yet, I'm sure you and I, sadly, are not surprised, because maybe now we can just mention the USS Liberty and why you named one of the boats the Liberty.
Well, we had these two small fishing boats, and we had a contest. And one of the women who works with us, who lives in Israel, said, I think you need to name the second boat the Liberty, because Israel is not going to attack the Liberty twice. And we said, yeah, that's a great idea. I wonder how many Americans even know that Israel attacked an American ship in 1967 and murdered 34 of our sailors and wounded 170. And how many people even know that Israel had done that? So let's name the boat in honor of the USS Liberty. And before we leave, we will throw roses into the sea in honor of the 34 sailors who were murdered and also the 12 fishermen from Gaza who have been murdered over the last few years by Israeli gunboats. And that's what we did.
And, you know, the Liberty is the anniversary of the attack on the Liberty is coming up next year. This will be the 50th anniversary. A group of people have put together a website called Honor Liberty Vets, and is attempting to put billboards around the United States, basically just saying, help Liberty Vets attacked by Israel, honorlibertyvets.org. And I've been helping on that project. We're having a number of places. It's very difficult to get the billboards up because there's so much pressure by groups like the so-called Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish Federations. All were opposing honoring Liberty Vets. You know, again, that's just an astounding situation because these are supposed to be American institutions. These are American veterans who served their country, who, you know, were attacked extremely viciously by Israeli forces in an attack that lasted somewhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours. That's, you know, a prolonged attack. And yet it's difficult to get a billboard up that asks people to honor Liberty Vets, which, again, just shows the power of the Israel lobby in the United States and what kind of pervasive power that is.
I'm like you. I'm constantly shocked over the fact that Americans don't know that the one time Americans were attacked and killed, they were attacked by a so-called ally, and that's Israel. And that nobody, both you and I know several of the veterans, and you know they were honored in a shipyard instead of honored with a medal in the president's office. And this is now, 49 years later? And people still are amazed if they're told that story. I've had people tell me they don't believe me. They just don't believe it. They don't believe that really happened until they go and look at it for themselves, and then they're outraged.
That's true. I remember talking to a retired naval captain, that's quite a high rank, who had never heard of it before. Now, a lot of active duty people have heard of it, and many have not. But one reason people have not heard about it is there is such an amazing cover-up of it. The American Legion, for example, that was founded after World War I to help American veterans. You know, American, you know, young, used to be only young men, now it's young men and young women. Are sent abroad in various wars and you know, come back often with great damage, physical or possibly psychological at times, and they deserve to be helped by the government that sent them over, and yet often they're abandoned. And in the case of the Liberty, they were certainly abandoned. But here we have the American Legion that was founded specifically to help American veterans. The management of the American Legion is so disdainful and disrespectful of USS Liberty veterans that they now won't even allow them to have a booth at their annual convention. You know, this is the most decorated crew since World War II, and yet we've got the management of the American Legion prohibiting them from even having a presence at the annual convention, even though the membership of the American Legion is very supportive of Liberty veterans.
Well, you know, that cover-up started from the moment Lyndon Johnson called the U.S. Air Force went up to intercept the Israeli Air Force, and Johnson, President Johnson, called them back and said, "We don't attack an ally." And from that moment on, Israel has had a stranglehold on dozens and dozens of politicians in the United States. And I like you, find it appalling that nobody holds Israel accountable for anything, whether it's the attack on the USS Liberty, the attack on our ship, the continuous attacks on Palestinians, and the confiscation of their land and their resources, and people ignore it.
That's right, the Liberty is so significant, both because, of course, those families of the people who were killed. I've met some of the sisters, you know, and they talk about their brothers, and they have the right to justice and full disclosure about what happened to them. But it also, in addition to that, it sent such a terrible message because it showed the militarists in Israel that if they can attack and try to sink a U.S. Navy ship, kill American servicemen, and yet have the amount of money to U.S. tax money sent to Israel go up the following year, it sent the message that they could do anything to Palestinians, anything to people in Gaza, and they can get away with it.
Yes,
you know,
and they have.
That's the message that's sent until all of us join together and say, no, that's not the case anymore.
And it's going to have to be the people that are going to do that, because the politicians are not, and certainly neither are the corporations. It's going to have to be an uprising of people who are saying, no more and not in my name will I allow this to continue. It happened when South Africa apartheid finally fell apart. And the same thing is going to end up happening to Israel, but it's painful to watch that the real people paying the price for this are the Palestinians.
That's right, absolutely, and neighboring countries. You know, all these other countries that have been attacked by Israel through the years, Egypt, Syria, different parts of the world. The war in Iraq was another devastating war that was very much tied to Israel. So, you know, there's just massive loss of life and misery and death and suffering, children being arrested in large numbers there. What is it now? I think there are currently about 500 Palestinian children being held by Israel under really appalling conditions.
Right.
This goes on year after year after year,
right.
You know, until enough people wake up and demand a change.
Well, and of course, those of us who support justice in Palestine are also marginalized and demonized, as you and I well know.
That's right. I was going to get into that. Here we have, you know, as you've described, whenever something's done that Israel doesn't like, whoever tells the facts is then there's, you know, this character assassination. You know, your group at first were called, you know, teenagers, then aging hippies, then terrorists. Or, you know, it's always character assassination against whoever tries to do something to stop the oppression, to bring justice. And then it becomes more insidious, I think, as some of us have found, those of us that have been working for many years on this, then there are more insidious attacks where we're called all sorts of vicious names that have no foundation, and yet they get away with that. I think, you know, if you look at your Wikipedia page, there's, you know, the quote controversy about Greta Berlin. Do you want
right.
to just spend a minute or two and maybe tell about that?
Right. It was Greta Berlin, the anti-Semite, because I wanted to watch a video. And, of course, my response, you've heard me say this before, my response has always been, look, I was married for 14 years to an Arab and 14 years to a Jew. And if anybody has the right to be anti-Semitic, I do. And usually people will laugh and they begin to realize how ridiculous this is. And first of all, who's going to tell me whether I have a right or not to have a right to watch a video? This has become the new McCarthyism. The name calling for people who are trying their hardest to tell the truth has become the new McCarthyism. So you can't watch this video, you can't read this book, you can't go see this movie, and God forbid that you come out and you actually say something that is controversial. And I find that appalling.
That's what
is happening. It's happening to you. It's happened to me. It's happened to people like Stephen Hawking. Anybody who stands up for justice for Palestine has been called an anti-Semite. I'm at the point now where I'm honored. I'm fitting in with Jimmy Carter and Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu and you. It's a great group.
Well, it is. You know, it's certainly, I'm pleased at the illustrious people that we're being grouped with that are truly principled, courageous, very valuable people that are trying to speak out for justice and fairness. These are qualities that most people respect and feel that we should endorse as individuals and as a country. And yet there are these attacks on us. You know, both you and I we're not young. I have quite a few grandchildren.
I'm the same age Bernie Sanders is and proud of it.
So we have life history, and we both have life histories where we were, you know, part of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era against the South African apartheid, took part in the civil rights movement for a number of years. I was arrested in a small demonstration taking part in that. So we have a life history. This isn't the first time as individuals that we have opposed injustice.
That's right.
And yet there are these attempts to say that we're racist or we're anti-Semitic or we're bigots because we're working on Palestine. It's just not true. As you say, it's the new McCarthyism. It's the new, well, don't talk to anybody except the people we tell you that you're allowed to talk to.
And don't watch anything unless we tell you. And don't talk about any controversial authors or any controversial books because we're going to call you anti-Semitic. And the unfortunate thing is that term what used to mean something means nothing any longer.
It's true. It's actually beginning to change its meaning, I think, quite a bit. Certainly in the dictionary, it's now, I think, like the fifth or sixth. If you look at an unabridged dictionary, it will say that criticism of Israel, you know, one of the definitions of anti-Semitism is criticism of Israel. And we know that given the apartheid-like system within Israel itself, the treatment of Palestinians both within Israel itself and especially in the occupied territories should be, we're morally required to criticize and expose what's being done.
Yeah.
So this is making anti-Semitism really, it then connects to a positive behavior. You know, it's completely changing the meaning of that term.
And it's funny because you and I know so many Jewish advocates and activists who work with us who you know, who are appalled, and they don't want to have any, they don't want to have anything to do with Israel. They don't want to have anything to do with members of their tribe that are acting like thugs. And so, in part, it's encouraging when you see many people like Hajo Meyer and Hedy Epstein, both of whom are survivors of the Holocaust, stand out and say, never again means never again for everyone, not just never again for Jews. And Jews don't have the same right to do to the Palestinians what was done to them. And so I do end up getting encouraged by that, because we are not willing to be shut up or to be shut out and shut up.
That's right. And as you say, I mean, one of the, you know, there were some Jewish Americans originally were opposed to Zionism for very good reasons. One of the best authors about Zionism was a man named Alfred Lilienthal, who happened to be Jewish and had wrote a number of excellent books. One of the best analysts today discussing the Israel lobby, who has discussed the lobby for many, many years, is named Jeff Blankford, who also comes from a Jewish background. So, you know, this whole calling people anti-Semitic is truly just nonsense, but it's a tactic, and it's starting to wear out. I should remind listeners that this is the People Speak radio program, and I'm Allison Weir speaking with Greta Berlin, founder of the Free Gaza Movement. And we're down to about our last 10 minutes, Greta, so I promised the organizers of this radio show that we would talk about the presidential candidates a little bit. And I think, you know, this is sort of interesting because especially we're both being called anti-Semitic. But I think both of us, even though Bernie Sanders' statements on Palestine are not nearly probably as strong as, certainly not as strong as I would want them to be, and I suspect not as strong as you would want them to be, I think we're still very excited about Bernie Sanders and are hoping and that people will vote for him.
Yep. I'm quite enthusiastic about him. And in fact, they did a survey, I guess, last week of the Arab American community in the United States, and they found that that community is overwhelmingly voting for Bernie Sanders, which is another indication that people vote what they hope will be a candidate who brings some kind of justice, not just to Palestine, but to our country that's just completely messed up right now. And he brings hope, and you can see the young people who have gathered around him. I talked to a good friend of mine today, and I said, what happens if Bernie doesn't get the nomination? And she said, I'm not voting for Hillary. And I said, yeah, well, I think that's the way a lot of us feel. And so if the Democratic Party isn't smart and doesn't start to realize that the only person that's really going to be Donald Trump is going to be Bernie Sanders, then the Democratic Party is going to be is going to lose. Because I don't think most of us can possibly stomach the idea of voting for Hillary.
No, I agree. Anybody that, you know, there are, of course, many, many important issues that candidates have to discuss and that presidents will be dealing with, you know, huge numbers of domestic issues that are hugely important. But certainly one of the most important issues I think everybody should be concerned with and is concerned with is loss of life. You know, how many people will be killed in the next war or the next so-called intervention in Libya or Iraq, or the push to attack Iran. And Hillary has been for every war that she possibly could endorse.
That's right.
The massive death toll that Hillary has played a role in and been in favor of is appalling.
Right. The fact that she said about Libya, "We came, we saw, he died," was so repulsive that people need to remember that she thought that was funny.
That's
and
right.
The country of Libya is in chaos right now. And apparently this seems to be okay for many Americans who say, well, at least the war isn't in the United States. It's over there with the Arabs. I've heard that said to me before. And I said, but we've lost people there as well. And it's going to come back. And again, I'll say, I live in France. And you can see the refugee problem that is coming out of Syria has impacted Europe hugely. And it's because it's blowback. Those refugees are coming because they're fleeing war. They're not coming for economic opportunity. And so Europe is now paying the price for what the United States started.
That's right, exactly. And it's coming here. We're not escaping from it. And everybody that's looked into Syria and the rise of what's called ISIS, it's very connected to the destruction of Iraq. Our invasion of Iraq, this was a country that had done nothing to us, that had nothing to do with 9/11, despite the fact that media coverage sometimes implied that. It had nothing to do with it. We now know, as many of us knew ahead of time, there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And yet, because of these neoconservatives, who, as they wrote in this Israeli media very openly, wrote about Feith, Pearl, Wolfowitz, a whole group of them, 25 or more, that were all close to one another, all very, very passionately devoted to Israel, pushed the U.S. to invade Iraq. This is documented in a number of excellent books, as well, as I said, in the Israeli media. That invasion then destroyed Iraq, destabilized the whole region, and has eventually led to what we're seeing in Syria now. Now we're seeing these, massive numbers of desperate refugees going into Europe, into France and other areas. Some of them now are being taken in here because most Americans do actually want to help other people. So now there's the controversy, about different communities bringing in refugees. And we need to look at the source of what's going on, and what's so much of this is connected to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. That's the core issue of the Middle East.
Yes, Palestine's at the heart of all of this. And that's what needs to be resolved more than anything. This has been almost a 70-year injustice. Our entire lifetime has been spent watching Israel do its best to destroy an entire culture, slow motion, bit by bit, piece by piece. And it's time we said, that's enough.
That's right. This is the time that we can bring an end to it. I feel we can. It's the American public that can finally do that. When we decide and we tell our candidates that we are now voting according to their stand on Israel-Palestine, we want moral and rational policies, and we haven't been getting those for decades now. Those have been non-existent. But when the American voters demand that, we'll get those, and that's when we can finally bring a change to this. We're almost at the end here. Greta, thanks so much for being with us on the show tonight. I'm sure that they'll want you again and again.
Thank you.
It
was great.
People have been listening to The People Speak. I'm your host for tonight, Allison Weir. Greta Berlin is the founder of Free Gaza, one of the co-editors of the wonderful book Freedom Sailors. She helped to initiate the whole flotilla movement. I urge you to buy her book and go to the website, freegaza.org. Also, I know Free Gaza and Greta herself are very active on Facebook. That's another place you can connect with them. Next week, The People Speak will be on again on Tuesday. And it looks like they're having a wonderful guest, William Pepper, who's a human rights lawyer. So I hope that people will tune in again next week to The People Speak. Thank you for allowing me to be the guest host tonight. I'm Allison Weir, and thank you, Greta, once again for being on the show.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.